Welcome to tonight's episode of the Remso Martinez Experience. Before we get started, I want to go ahead and give a shout out to some of this episode's sponsors. From self-publishing to podcasting and passive income development, I offer ongoing self-development courses at Champion Pundit Academy, as well as one-on-one private consultations to take you from zero to hero in no time. Learn more at championpunditacademy.com. That's championpunditacademy.com. You want to know what you need more of in your life? Politics. Yeah, nobody ever said that. But if you've got to go ahead and spend money on one nonfiction book, it's got to be the ultimate clash of wisdom, awesomeness, and then obviously the politics. But why not a little bit of comedy? Why not a little bit of a memoir? Why not something that's going to make you say, hey, I actually enjoyed reading this. I laughed. I learned something in the process. Check out my book. It's an Amazon bestseller. You may have heard of it. It's Stay Away from the Libertarians. It talks about all the things you think you might know about libertarians, plus a lot of things that I bet dollars to donuts you don't know about. You can get it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble online. So go on right now. You can get it in print or ebook or Kindle or whatever you call it. Just go out and get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble online today. It's Stay Away from the Libertarians by Remso W. Martinez. Happens to be me. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome once again to the Remso Martinez Experience. I'm your host, as always, Remso W. Martinez. Go ahead and do me a favor. Follow me on Twitter at Remso4VA. That's four written out, F-O-R-V-A, Remso4VA. Follow me there. I'll follow you back. Hey, for some of you out there that have a TikTok account, I finally understand what the craze is. And honestly, as someone that grew up in like the Vine generation, I'm really digging this because it's great to be on a social media platform where people actually create stuff that's funny. And I can tell you that after having a TikTok account for 24 hours, I've only wasted about 22 hours just watching it continuously. So go ahead and follow your boy on there at Remso ++ because some bastard just took my regular name. So I had to go ahead and add those special characters to it. So let's go ahead and see what we can get going on there. So today's topic is something that is really much of a listener-demanded conversation. I've been getting a lot of shit from people recently, and maybe rightfully so, but I feel like it is a good conversation to have. So anyone that knows me, that's listened to the show for years, that's read my work, that purchased my book, you understand one thing. I've always been pretty upfront with you about controversial ideas I have. And somebody tried saying that I've never been on the record about this before. I found myself writing about it. I found myself stating it. I found myself, it was actually a brief sentence in my book. I've always been, for the most part, I want to say at least going back the last 3 years, I've been a supporter of universal basic income. And for those of you that don't know what that means, that basically means that it's an alternative to the current welfare state that we currently have. And essentially what it means is that we give every American from the ages of 16 or 18 to 65 like $1,000 a month and nothing else. And that's it. There's no more Medicaid. There's no more housing allowances. There's no more food stamps. Everyone just gets that guaranteed income. When inflation goes up, the value stays. So that way you're not getting less or anything else like that. Quantitative easing doesn't affect it. It's just a lump sum of cash and that's it. And as someone that wants to essentially eliminate the current welfare state the way that we have it, I don't necessarily understand a lot of the animosity towards it. Now, a lot of people on Facebook, for example, they start screaming, well, isn't taxation theft? Yeah, but I mean, we're getting stolen from anyway, and we're not going to go from our current system to absolutely nothing overnight. So I want to just have a conversation about this. I don't want this to just be an echo chamber. Let's go ahead and jump into it. To go ahead and, you know, have this conversation with me, I went ahead and invited my old friend Logan Albright from Free the People on the show to, you know, tell me where I might be wrong about this. And if I'm wrong, I'll gladly admit I'm wrong. I don't like to have wrong opinions or wrong ideas if I believe that they are wrong. So let's go ahead and just start the conversation. Logan, thanks for coming on this morning.
Hey, Remzo. Nice to talk to you as always.
So when you heard that I was a UBI supporter, what was your initial reaction?
Well, like some of your viewers, I was a little surprised because I remember last time I was on this podcast, we had a long conversation about how taxation is theft. And, you know, for UBI, you're going to have to get that money from somewhere. It's going to have to come from some people and go to other people. So I was a little surprised to hear you support it. But, there's a lot of libertarians who have some positive feelings about it as an alternative to the current welfare system. And I understand their arguments, but I do think you are wrong on this one.
So just to kind of let you know where I'm coming from, I actually got this idea by watching Milton Friedman get interviewed about this about probably 2.5 years ago. I was watching this video on YouTube where Milton Friedman, and I'm a bit different from you. Like I understand the Austrian school, but I tend to lean on more of Friedman's Chicago school type of style when it comes to things, because I just feel that's what transfers more over into our post-Keynesian economic way of thinking. So I think that Austrian economics is the goal for libertarians, but if we want to start making any type of headway, you know, the Chicago school of thought is probably what I believe is what's going to get us any type of mileage on this. So when Friedman talked about this, he basically said that, you know, because of our current fiat banking system where we're just manipulating our currency, because of the threat of artificial intelligence, and that interview was like in the late 70s, and he's already talking about the threat of AI. That's what really got me. And when I go ahead and I listen to people like Elon Musk, Bill Gates, when they start saying that, you know, it's not going to be good enough just to be good at your job, you're going to have to be better than perfect when it comes to a machine, that really does freak me out. And I've never necessarily believed that the dawn of artificial intelligence and the way that we imagine it is going to be anything like the invention of the steam engine. Like, we're about to see a rapid displacement of more jobs than any other point in human history. And when we look at things like the food service industry, trucking, which hires about 15 million Americans right now, like, I'm really worried that if we have, I think, Andrew Yang, who's running for president as a Democrat on essentially just a UBI platform, I've been paying a lot of attention to him. He's like, you know, you're going to have 30 million people unemployed within a decade. What happens when people miss their, you know, when they don't pay their bills on time, when they can't pay for their kids to, you know, go to school or something? We're going to have a lot of unemployed, angry people that are going to go ahead and start listening to people like Bernie Sanders, who, for the record, we're recording this on the day that Bernie Sanders just announced he's running for president. I think it's hilarious that he did that on the anniversary of FDR signing the bill, which put Japanese Americans in internment camps. So I think that's kind of funny. But essentially what we're dealing with is we're dealing with a problem caused by government. We're dealing with a problem caused by capitalism. And everyday working class Americans are going to fall victim because, for once, the free market is being eaten alive by its child automation. So this is the type of thing I'm worried about. I don't think it's a matter of if it could work. I think it's a matter of we don't really have a choice in this matter.
Well, people have been worried about automation for pretty much ever. Ever since they've started inventing machines, people have been concerned that it's going to destroy jobs and it's going to put people out of work. And, you know, I know AI might be a different animal. I heard a lot of people saying that. They may say it's different. But history has shown us so far that every time a new technology has come along, it has displaced some jobs, true, but it's always created more opportunity for workers rather than less opportunity. And it's always made the lives of workers better rather than worse. And that's been the case through every kind of development. You had the Luddites complaining about the weaving machines and everything. So far, that's always been the case. So until I see really good evidence to convince me otherwise, I'm going to assume that's going to continue to be the case. It's possible that AI is going to displace everybody, but it hasn't happened yet. And as you said, Milton Friedman was worried about this in the 70s. It was 50 years ago. Still hasn't happened. And I'd rather cross that bridge when we come to it, if it actually does become a problem, because so far it's been a lot of crying wolf and it hasn't been a problem in the past.
Yeah, I get where you're coming from. My biggest fear is that when people act irrationally, they make really dangerous and stupid decisions. And for example, I mean, you had, I think it was Alan Greenspan who said, and this is a guy who liked Ayn Rand for a while. He was saying back in 2007, 2008, we need to nationalize all the banks. And then you had all those Republicans that joined the Democrats and voted for TARP. Like, people make really bad decisions when they're not getting paid. And the thing about UBI is I like the fact that it's indiscriminate. Everyone gets it. And at that point, what you do with it is really it's like everyone around you will see whether or not you're being responsible with it. And when we look at the, you know, amount of money that's being spent on the current welfare state in terms of entitlements, what you're doing is you're essentially cutting it down, because $1,000 a month for every American, that's going to be a lot less than we're currently spending on healthcare, on education, all these things that people don't even know that they're getting. All these, you know, libertarians and conservatives that believe, oh, I'm a true anti-state type of guy. At the end of the day, everybody who has a job and, you know, interacts with the world around them, they're getting something in some form eventually. So giving everyone $1,000 a month, saying this is all you're getting, eliminating a whole bunch of federal employees, and what we saw from this recent shutdown is we have a lot of unessential people. And I don't know about you, Logan, but when I look at the private sector, I don't see anyone hiring unessential people. Like, that's just hilarious. When they say we need to go ahead and help the unessential workers, it's like that's an oxymoron. But it's getting to the point where this might be a step in the right direction in terms of downsizing the welfare state. So if somebody, I think Gary Johnson even brought this up in 2016, they said we can go ahead and eliminate a lot of our current entitlement programs just by instituting a form of UBI. Do you think that's a step in the right direction, or do you think that's missing the point?
I think it's partially missing the point, but more than that, I think it's one of these ideas like the consumption tax that kind of sounds good on paper, but you run into real problems in implementation. You mentioned earlier that it would not be adjusted for inflation. Like, I see a real problem with if you give everybody in the country more money than they currently have, $1,000 extra, there's no reason why merchants aren't going to charge more for their goods and services. So you're going to have inflation already creeping in. You're going to have prices rising. And pretty soon people are going to say, this $1,000 a month isn't enough to live on. It's not a living wage. We need more. So you'll give them more, and then prices will rise again. And it'll be this endless cycle of inflation getting more. I see that as a real problem. And we've seen that with things like the minimum wage. They just keep creeping up more and more and more as people demand and complain that they're not getting a living wage. So I think that's going to be a real cost problem. I also think that, you know, there's a cost problem in where you get the money from in the first place. Like you said, you're going to eliminate all these other welfare programs. Well, are you really going to eliminate all these other welfare programs? Are you going to be able to stop the popular demand for, say, food stamps or for, you know, free education or free healthcare and things like that? I see that as a real problem. So I think there's a lot of practical problems with implementing it, even if I thought it was a good idea on paper, which I don't really think it is.
I see where you're coming from. I think, you know, one thing that's always bothered me is a few years ago, this one guy, I think he was from the Hoover Institute, he went ahead and told me that, and this is before I really became like a real like self-identified libertarian. I was kind of jumping into that, you know, part of the lake, so to speak. I mentioned that, you know, I don't like entitlements. I don't like welfare states. I don't like the welfare state. Actually, I think this is like around 2013-ish. Yeah, this is like around 2013. I basically said, I don't like everything, but I don't have a problem with WIC, women, infant, and children. Like I said at the time, and he looked at me as if I just smacked his grandmother, and he said, so you get, you know, as the market will show you get more of what you invest in. So when you're investing in single mothers or mothers living in poverty and you're subsidizing food for their children, what are you going to get more of? You're going to get more single mothers living in poverty who need you to help pay for food for their children. And that kind of took me back a bit because I was like, wow, that makes a lot of sense. The thing about UBI is that we're going to, you know, the incentive factor to stay on welfare that we have now is removed by it, because you look at what I think it was Arthur Brooks mentioned in his book, The Conservative Heart. In our current welfare system, if you're like a single mother, for example, and you're getting you know, a welfare check at the end of each month, you can't get a job or else all that money goes away. And you're probably making more money. You're probably making around 60K a year from just welfare than you would a typical job. And if you get married, that money goes away too. So I think somebody said the government's like a bad polygamist. You can cheat on me, you could shit talk me, you could do whatever, but the moment you try and get away from me, I'm cutting you off entirely. With UBI, I'm fully aware that you're going to have several different types of people. You're going to have the people that spend it all on Rolexes and cameras and shit, and then you're going to have the people that save it, and those are the, quote, money hoarders if you're coming from a Keynesian view, and then you're going to have the people that spend it on hookers and blow. So at the end of the day, it's like we're putting a lot more of control and the responsibility and the outcomes back on the end consumer, which is the American taxpayer who'd be getting this. And I do want to kind of, you know, rewind this a little bit. You mentioned that a consumption tax would be worse than, you know, or if not worse, it would be just as bad as the current income tax system. I don't necessarily know if I agree with that, because with the income tax, it's almost like, you know, it's almost like a penalty for being successful. Whereas with the consumption tax, it's almost like UBI in a sense. It's indiscriminate, and it's, you know, this is gonna make some people scream and make their eyes bleed, but it's, quote, voluntary, because you don't have to pay for certain things. You could choose to pay into it, which means you've consented to the tax on that. So why don't you like the consumption tax as an idea?
Oh, well, that's the point I was making, is that I think the consumption tax is a better idea than the income tax.
Oh, okay.
But I don't think you can implement it practically, because the idea behind the consumption tax is it replaces all the other taxes. You get rid of the income tax, you get rid of the property taxes, you just have a consumption tax. But in practicality, how do you do that? I don't think you're going to get rid of the income tax. So while I'd like to do it in practice, in theory, in practice, I think you're going to end up with an additional tax into the ones we already have, which would be a step in the wrong direction. But you're right. It makes more sense theoretically on paper. I just think the political reality is people always want more free stuff, and you're not going to be able to take away things like the income tax. Or if you do take them away, they're going to gradually creep back in. So you're going to have things like the consumption tax on top of the taxes we already have instead of in place of those taxes. That's why I oppose it, not because I think it's a bad idea in theory. Now, you brought up incentives, which I'm really glad you brought up, because my training is in economics and we think entirely in terms of incentives. And you're absolutely right that the incentives of the current welfare system are very bad, and they incentivize people to stay on welfare and not get work. And I think that's a real problem that needs to be addressed. However, the UBI incentive problem is, in my opinion, just as bad, because if you're giving everybody enough money to live on without working, then there's not that much incentive to get a job and work. Now, obviously, a lot of people will. A lot of people want to live more extravagant lifestyles. A lot of people want to live above subsistence level. A lot of people just like working and want to do something with their lives, which is great. But there's going to be a lot of people, and I know this from personal experience as well as from empirical data, who are happy just to take their income and spend it and not do anything else. And I worry that when you have a huge class of people who are doing that, the economy shrinks because you have fewer people producing goods and services. The total amount of money in the economy shrinks, which means you have a smaller tax base to get the money for the UBI in the first place from, which means you have to raise taxes on everybody. And that just creates another cycle where you have the economy continually shrinking, fewer and fewer people working, and a smaller group of people that you are able to take that money from. And this isn't just theory, because they have tried UBI in a couple of places. They tried it in Finland in 2016, and they discontinued it in 2018 because they found the incentive against work was so strong, people were not getting jobs. And they actually tried it in the United States in the 1970s. It wasn't exactly a UBI, but it was something similar. They tried.
Was that the one that Nixon tried to implement?
I'm not sure. I think Nixon was in power. Yeah, it was a controlled study in four different states, and they found that for every $1,000 they put into the UBI, they lost $600 and something worth of productive work, because people just stopped working when they got the free money. So I see that as a real problem with UBI that I don't know how you address.
You bring up two things, and I mean, we were discussing this earlier. There's the tax portion of it, then there's the incentive portion of it. When we look at states like Texas and Florida that don't have an income tax, for example, what we're seeing is that more jobs are coming there. The standard of living is much better than that of, you know, especially, you know, the lifestyles that people on the coast tend to live, and it's far better than middle America. Wouldn't you say that the consumption tax or sales tax in Florida and Texas is kind of proof that it can work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the states that don't have income taxes are great, and I would heartily encourage getting rid of income taxes. And if you can practically do it where you replace an income tax with a consumption tax, I'm not against that. But I am against piling the consumption tax on top of the income tax, which I think is what would end up happening on a federal level.
So where do you think Friedman, kind of switching the topic a little bit, where do you think Friedman got kind of seduced by this idea? Because I know that many people have criticized him for his opinion on the Fed. He was against the gold standard, so he actually supported the U.S. getting rid of the gold standard. He thought it was outdated and inadequate for what we were getting towards. Where do you think his kind of moment of change came? Because for me, it was really – you know, this is better than what we currently have. I'm all for eliminating the current system. Why do you think so many other libertarians are kind of into this idea? Because what I'm seeing is that we tend to be a bit of a minority, but everyone comes at it from a different perspective. Why do you think this has been something that's crept into the libertarian discussion?
Well, for one thing, I think it's an attempt at pragmatism where you're trying to come up with a solution that might be politically possible, whereas the solution that a lot of libertarians, including myself, come up with is to just get rid of government entirely, which is not politically possible. So there's that. I think for Friedman and a lot of economists, there is this the allure of design, which is really the difference between the Austrian school and the other schools of economics, is they feel like because they're really smart economists who have studied how the economy works, they can come up with a more efficient system than the free market. They can come up with a better way of organizing things. And so there's that allure. Even people who are resistant to it, like Friedman generally is, there's a certain allure of thinking, I've come up with a better idea, I'm going to implement it and it'll work, without thinking about all the unintended consequences. And then the third thing is, it's a real problem for libertarians, is this idea of compassion. You know, no one wants poor people to be poor. No one wants people to be starving to death or suffering or without jobs. Libertarians don't want that. We want to help people. We want people to be better off. But there's this popular conception out there that because we don't believe in the welfare state, we want poor people to suffer and we don't care about them. And I think in order to try to combat that, people have proposed ideas like this. And I think where they go wrong is that just giving people free money doesn't actually help. The thing that has historically helped poor people become not poor is opportunity, capitalism, jobs, work, innovation, technology. Those are the things that have made people not poor. Giving people free money has not made people not poor.
So you brought up something which I think is really important because it really does kind of show where I am different in terms of my intentions of UBI. You mentioned that, you know, libertarians, just like anyone else, we feel bad when we see homeless people. We feel bad when we see people living, you know, a standard of life, which we're like, we shouldn't be living this way in, you know, a developed nation, especially the United States. But my thing is this. I'm coming at it from less of the view of I want more people out of poverty, and it's more of I want people to take more responsibility. And I got into an argument with a leftist friend of mine recently, and he hates the idea of UBI because of several things. One, it cuts out a large chunk of the money people are currently getting in their current welfare system. And two, it will eliminate possibly a third of federal workers, which I heard that and I was like, oh, okay, well, if we don't need them, we don't need them. Put that money back to the taxpayers. Because when we look at our giant bureaucratic state, we have so many people, a lot of unessential people, who are working just administering the welfare state, making sure that, you know, people are getting their Social Security checks, enrolling people into all of these different programs, WIC housing, etc. If we get rid of that, then that's I'd see that as a good thing because that means that the federal government's spending less money. That means they don't really have necessarily a good argument to spend or tax more. So when it comes to that, I could totally see where he's like, they're getting less and then we'll have more unemployed people. And then how does UBI help them?
Yeah, I think there were definitely leftist critiques of UBI as well. I'm not as familiar with those because I haven't really studied it. But yeah, there's a lot of problems with it. And I think about the poverty thing, you know, people forget that poverty is the default state of humankind. When we're born, we have nothing. We're poor. If we don't find some way to find food and shelter, we're going to die. And so all of human existence has been trying to lift people out of poverty. There's no cause of poverty. People talk about the causes of poverty. Poverty is the default. Anything that's not poverty is the thing we should look at the cause of. And when you look at the United States, we have people who are poor. We have people who are homeless. But compared to 100 years ago, compared to every other country in the world, particularly African and Asian nations, You know, our poor people are doing much better than poor people in other nations, and we have to do better. I'm not saying we should just be content with that and just let them be poor, but I think people tend to get in their bubble and forget that, you know, what's considered poor in the United States would be considered pretty well off in a lot of countries around the world. And the reason for that is that we've given people opportunity, we've given people freedom, we've given people the ability to raise themselves up out of poverty. And we haven't just given people free money, which doesn't create any kind of value for the economy. It doesn't create any kind of new productivity. It doesn't move us forward in any way. It just maintains the status quo at best. And in practice, it's actually done worse because it disincentivizes people from working, and you end up with people who just get poorer and poorer over time.
I don't necessarily think that $1,000 a month, though, is really going to make someone say, yeah, I'm going to work less. Like, you know, we live in Northern Virginia. Like, $1,000 a month for us, like, that would be nice. But for a majority of the middle class and, you know, a lot of the government contractors that live here, $1,000 a month is, you know, what they spend on fast food and other shit alone. When you go to, like, you know, Selma, Alabama, for example, and I lived outside of there for 2 years, like, Selma is like the Detroit of the South, in a sense. Like, so many people are on the dole, it's ridiculous. And you give them $1,000 a month, I know that there are some people who live there who would think, I need any way to get out of there. So I would say that, you know, the opportunity to actually use it to start a business, to invest in a skill, to do something like that. Like, here's the thing. If you're going to get taxed and you're going to get a little bit of money back, you might as well use a little bit of that money to actually get out of the situation you need. So that way, the extra $1,000 a month doesn't matter.
Well, you say that, Rimzo, but that's because you are an entrepreneurial guy and an ambitious guy. You know, I've worked in minimum wage jobs before. Well, not exactly minimum wage, but close to minimum wage jobs before. I worked in a record store in New York City. And when the record store went out of business, a lot of my coworkers, I heard them say, you know, I'm going to go on unemployment and I'm going to stay on unemployment until it runs out. And I'm not going to look for another job, because they were perfectly happy just to collect a check and not work. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was enough for them to live on. And I think there's a lot of people who have that mindset. And like I said before, the empirical data does back that up. The time when they tried it in Finland, the times when they tried it in the United States, a lot of people do either work less or stop working entirely. So because there's some people who would certainly work and continue to try to earn money and do things, doesn't mean everybody would. The other point I wanted to make is, you know, given that now we don't have automation of everything, we have a lot of jobs that are – it's kind of hard to find people who want to do them. They're not good jobs. They're low-paying jobs. Things like garbage men, things like picking crops in fields, you know, being hotel maids, things like that. If you give everybody a standard basic level of subsistence income, who's going to do those jobs?
The Mexican slogan. Give them the money too, right?
So I worry about who's going to do those jobs if you don't have someone being incentivized that, well, I need to put food on my table. I need to do these jobs.
True. So I kind of want to switch topics here, and I want to focus a little bit more on automation. I'm glad that we don't still have, you know, gaslit streetlights on our streets.
Gas is so much more pretty than electricity.
You're right. And, you know, as a fan of the Victorian era, I'm a bit nostalgic, but I'm glad that we don't have, like, the gas, you know, the lamplighters union, for example.
Right.
So I feel like a hypocrite when I say that getting rid of the trucking industry in its current form is going to be just like that, because, you know, with automation, like, I will admit, like, I probably fall into the category of a Luddite. I'm just going to put that out there. Maybe my fears are too exaggerative because I fear a future that is either Terminator or Blade Runner. And the thing is, while I do think that automation is going to be a net positive for humanity, I'm afraid of the collateral cultural costs to us in the meantime. Because I remember I was just a kid when the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis and the saving and loan scandal, you know, basically destroyed the country. And then people were crying out for the government to come and save them. Right now, we've got Trump, who, as much as I like some of the things he's doing, he's not a fiscal conservative. I mean, we're putting trillions onto the national debt. He's not a deficit hawk, and I think a lot of the Republicans have just abandoned trying to be deficit hawks. And now we have, you know, Uncle Steelmore jumping into the presidential race on top of a bunch of other people who were talking about free college and Medicaid for all. My thing is this: if people are desperate, they're going to make desperate decisions. And if, you know, this prediction, and at the end of the day, it's always a prediction because things could always turn differently. If we're about to lose 15 to 30 million jobs within the next 15 years, like, that really does freak me out. And I think that people are going to make really irrational choices that they wouldn't have made if they had at least a basic guaranteed income to prevent them from going and burning shit down.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from on that. I mean, I think the transition is going to be more gradual than you think it's going to be. And there might be a period of disruption where some people are out of work. Like, I think personally getting rid of the trucking industry would be amazing. That's such a dangerous industry. It's so hazardous to the people who work in it. They, you know, have to take all these drugs to stay awake all night and drive.
Like 40,000 people die a year in semi-truck related accidents too.
I mean, freeing up all those people to do something else with their time rather than just spend all the time driving back and forth across the country and endangering themselves and others, I think would be great for the economy. And I think as long as there's scarcity, as long as there's things people want they don't have, there's going to be jobs for people and there's going to be ways. And yeah, it's not going to be easy. People are going to have to relearn new skills and do other things that they haven't done before. But I mean, and like I said, history bears this out. There's always been new opportunities for people. And then if automation takes over to such an extent, if AI takes over to such an extent that we basically get rid of scarcity and computers can create everything for us, well, then we don't even need jobs anymore. We don't need money anymore because the robots will just do it for us. The only purpose of having money is to allocate scarce resources. And if AI gets rid of scarce resources, we won't need money. So I think there's either going to be enough work for everybody, which has always been the case in the past, or it's going to be such a dramatic shift that people won't need to work because robots can do it for them.
So then there's going to be no incentive to do anything. Because you could just – how many people do you know who would much rather just stay at home all day and watch Netflix and order takeout?
Yeah, there's a lot of people like that. And that's – you know, that is the real danger of AI, is if it gets to the point where no one needs to do anything anymore and all of our needs are taken care of for us. And it's like that movie WALL-E. Like that is a worry.
Oh, the fat people in the hover chairs?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that film really traumatized me as a kid.
I don't think that's going to happen. I think human needs and wants are endless, and I don't think we'll ever get to a point, at least not for hundreds and hundreds of years, where we can't do things for ourselves that are valuable. So I'm not too worried about it. But if we do get to that point, we won't have to worry about having jobs or having money because we won't need money anymore.
Is there anything about artificial intelligence that scares you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen Terminator. I'm worried. I've read the Asimov's laws of robotics.
Man, like an Amazon robot actually killed someone back in 2018. Yeah, on accident is what they're saying.
It is scary. And, you know, the idea that if you actually ever get true sentience into a computer, which I don't know if you will, there might be a real strong incentive for those computers to turn on us and try to do something to us. But for now, it's still science fiction. And I'm like, the AI that people talk about now is not really intelligence. It's just clever programming. It's just good robotics. So I worry about true sentience in robots or in computers, but I think we're a long way from that.
Yeah, I think – and this is me kind of jumping down the conspiracy rabbit hole, so to speak. But what really freaks me out is like, okay, Redbox – I think Redbox is evil. Because think about it. I think Redbox is evil because I think Redbox is a predecessor to sex robots being as easily obtained as a movie at Redbox. Because think about it. You've got a lot of people, especially here in D.C. I think it was Barry Goldwater back in 1966 that said most people in D.C. are just trying to get laid. You have a Redbox type of, you know, sex robot machine outside of your local Walgreens. You're having a bunch of dudes that are just spending all of their extra income on that because they don't want to go out and actually develop a meaningful relationship or even try and make contact with a human being. You're going to have a lot less productivity of that. And then they're going to be at home watching their Netflix, spooning their sex robot. And then what happens? We end up like the fat people in the hover chairs from WALL-E because now everything we want is just oversaturated. And I kind of, you know, I'm saying this in jest to a large degree, but I think that, and here's my one criticism of a lot of libertarians, I think we do ignore a lot of the arguments that conservatives are making in terms of, you know, keeping our culture alive to a certain degree. Because my biggest fear with, like, the trucking jobs, for example, is when people are desperate, they do desperate things. When we look at the American family, we see that in times of great recession or whenever we hit a depression, whenever we hit a large, you know, disastrous economic spell, you know, families are torn apart. People make bad decisions. If we believe that, you know, in the American idea that families that stick together are more productive and are better for our culture long term, then I'm afraid of what a lot of this automation is going to do. We're going to be more distractive. We're going to be less incentivized to work. We're going to be less incentivized to actually want to be better people because we're getting everything we want and we don't have to worry about that. And the thing about UBI is, you know, a lot of people at face value, they think it's convenient, but I want to say it's the most convenient, less convenient form of welfare that there is. And in the age of artificial intelligence, I think man comes out losing at the end of the day because it's not going to be good enough just to be good. We've got to be better than perfect.
Well, there's that Futurama episode about how all of civilization is just an attempt to impress the opposite sex. And once you have sex robots, all of civilization crumbles because people.
Exactly.
And, you know, I can see that happening in some place like Japan where you already have all the young men with video game addictions who aren't ever leaving their house.
They're dating their pillows and their
iPods.
It is
a problem. I tend to be a techno-optimist. I tend to think that things are going to get better. We're going to use technology to make things better for mankind. I understand the concerns. But even if I was a pessimist about it, I don't know what you do about it. Like, how you can't stop people from inventing new technologies and coming up with new ways to automate things. I don't think there's any realistic way to prevent that from happening. So if there's nothing you can do about it, why worry about it is my attitude. But I really do tend to be a techno-optimist, and I think the pattern of history so far has been that technology has made things better for people, and I think it will continue to make things better for people for a long time.
Yeah, and I will say that somebody on Twitter criticized me saying that I tried to act like Tucker Carlson Jr. Like Tucker Carlson wants to pass a law that prevents you from automizing away trucking jobs. I don't want to do that because anytime you get the government involved in something, you're going to get something way worse out of it. It's like I don't agree with all these people. And as a victim of online censorship, I don't want, you know, antitrust acts and, you know, anti-monopoly regulation thrown on Google, Twitter, Facebook, all this other stuff. So
you can't use regulation to hold back innovation. It just doesn't work. It's a bad idea. Yeah. And regarding the culture thing you were talking about, you know, I understand why people are worried about that and the people want to protect their culture totally. But I think, you know, trying to use laws to protect your cultures is the wrong way to go about it. If you want your culture to remain popular and propagate it, you know, it's up to you. You got to go out there and do it. You got to make your culture attractive to other people to join in and be part of it. You got to have, you know, whatever your culture is, you got to be out there celebrating it. It's up to the people who have that culture to protect it and to preserve it through celebrating it. Not through trying to like restrict people from coming into your town or telling people what they can and can't do or what language they can speak or what holidays they can celebrate or what religion they have to be through law. I think that's a bad way of going about it. I think you want to make your culture as attractive as possible to other people so it survives. And that's on the people who are in that culture, not on government.
Or I could build a wall that keeps the robot prostitutes out.
Yeah, I think you're going to keep the robot prostitutes in with that wall.
Logan, this has been a great discussion. You've definitely made me rethink a lot of the notions and thoughts that I had about UBI. And that, folks, I want this to be a long-term discussion because I'm afraid that this is going to be something that is going to jump into the popular political discourse very soon. And, you know, we might as well have this discussion going further. So, Logan, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and discuss this with me today. If anyone wants to follow your work with Free the People and everything else, how could they do so?
Oh, well, you can check us out on freethepeople.org. We're on YouTube if you search for Free the People. Not the Free People Clothing Company, but Free the People. Check us out on YouTube. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We're all over the place.
Good stuff. Well, Logan, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a blast as always.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, folks. So do you think that I got something wrong? Do you think that Logan got something wrong? Go ahead and leave us a voicemail. Go ahead and go to anchor.fm. Click on the show, the Remso Martinez Experience, and you can leave us a voice message. And what I'll do is I'll go ahead and play it on the next episode. And maybe we'll have Logan come back to go ahead and yell at you and say that you need to stop leaving angry voicemails for the show. But anyway, as always, go ahead and follow me on Twitter at Remso4VA, four written out, F-O-R-V-A, Remso4VA. Follow me, I'll follow you back. And tune in next time, folks. This is the Remso Martinez Experience. Take care.